Well, it wouldn't really matter to me, but I think that the way they set it up is some people have finals on other days and other nights, and it might conflict where they couldn't make both. So. Well, I don't think I can finish by this Thursday. Maybe I can, but. But yeah, it's quite a run for tonight. I hope I have more than one night's worth here. But the idea of what I had before is probably definitely not going to work out. Those extra sheets I passed out, I don't think we'll need those. But you have them in case you're interested in that area. So let's make it to 39, and that's all that will be on the exam. It'll be more like this.
Oh, okay.
Because that's the best I can usually do. tonight was especially hard when my son is in the middle of, he went from no job offers to three jobs. He's moved to Portland, and he went up there with, left a good job, went up to nothing, and now he's got three job offers, and we were on the phone back and forth trying to make a decision what's the best thing to do, and I thought, hey, guess what, I got to go to work, see you. But that's positive. Yeah, but that's a lot better than a few days ago. I had nothing. So. But anyway, it'll be like this on Thursday. So. I'll try to be here better. So Huey Long, he is the best known. In fact, before I do Huey Long, let's go back and put this into context. We're explaining why FDR in 1935 through 1936 embarks upon the Second New Deal. Now, it's not called the Second New Deal in 1934 or 35, it's not called the Second New Deal until the late 40s, early 50s, by historian, I used to know who this guy was, last name was Rauchy, I think, R-A-U-C-H-Y, and he was the historian, left-leaning historian, who first called it that, and it caught on, and most textbooks took it after that and used it. So it'd be like World War II wasn't called World War II until well into World War II. In fact, World War I remained the Great War up until the middle of the Second World War. So it's a construct. It's a historical put together by scholars after the fact. But it seems to be, as we mentioned in number 19, based on two things. First, what it is, the Second New Deal, is a turn to the left to making the programs more responsive to workers and farmers, the unemployed and the disadvantaged. Which, when I look at the First New Deal, seems to be the case to me, too. It doesn't look like there's that much advantage to businesses. But I guess at least in spirit, FDR was trying to be neutral and trying or at least he claims he is, trying to give benefit in every direction and every sector so it's not partisan. But he sees in the midterm elections of 1934 that the way the vote turned out is that those communities, which he's going to turn to helping, poured out strong on the vote for him, and those that, like the business community, et cetera, stayed pretty loyal Republican, which is not surprising. I mean, that's the kind of thing what one would expect in politics. But I think FDR was a bit hurt, thought that he should have had everybody on his side for what he was doing. So he kind of takes on an attitude that after this, in 1935 and 36, the laws will focus on protecting that voter base, either out of just the sheer raw politics of staying elected or out of a sense of maybe, I don't say revenge, but a sense of let's reward those who have worked with me. That's not the only reason for the Second New Deal. The other reason is, and this is a case where historians differ quite a bit on this. When I took the summer course at Stanford in 1999, David Kennedy, who's the author of the most popular AP textbook and probably just about most popular survey U.S. book for colleges called The American Pageant, used to be our textbook here a while back. When I brought this up, he disagreed and downplayed this, dismissed it as not that important. But if I can be so presumptuous, I think he's wrong from other historians, and that is the thunder on the left. He really de-emphasized that was not a big factor in the Second New Deal, but I think it is, and I think it's at least if it isn't as much as I think it is, there's evidence there to make the links. That the thunder on the left include these people like Coughlin, Townsend, Long, and Gerald K. Smith, who I'll talk about, all of them criticizing FDR from the perspective of that he had not done enough to help the common people, that he was still too much a moderate, too much trying to protect business and industry. So he's getting slammed from every direction. A thing we will not be tested over, but maybe we'll fit into this discussion on the second page, or last page, in number 41, where I have conservative opponents. I don't know if I've mentioned this to you or not, but Al Smith. Where do we know Al Smith from? Yes, the Catholic candidate who ran in 28 for the Democrats and lost. John W. Davis, where do we know him from? If he's not easy to remember, that's understandable, because other than the one thing I mentioned, that's about all we know. Later in life, he was the one who fought against the Brown case, fighting for segregation in schools. Lost, fortunately. But 30 years earlier, in 1924, how do we know John W. Davis? Yes, yes. He ran and lost against whom? Harding had died, so it was Coolidge. Yeah, Coolidge replaced Harding. So these two people joined this, or helped organize this organization called the Liberty League, along with the DuPont family, who was involved in the chemical industry as well as making war materials. These people are complaining about FDR being too liberal. These are conservative opponents, that FDR has endangered the free market system, that he's dangerously enlarged the scope and size of federal authority. DuPont, you can probably see why, because he's a businessman who got taxed heavy in the New Deal programs. But why would Smith and Davis be critics if they're members of the same party, Democratic Party? Well, on the high ground, you could say they want to see traditional laissez-faire politics that goes back to Andrew Jackson be protected, and that FDR has betrayed the ideology of the party. But on the low ground, we lost, he won. Gee, we should have won. I think it's as simple as that, that the mood of the country turned lucky for FDR when we were running. We could have been president. So I think that's a factor in that. But the Liberty League and other conservative opponents didn't really worry FDR. He could tell by the way the vote was going that they're in the minority. He was more concerned about the thunder on the leftists back on our previous page, such as Townsend and Coughlin. And the one that worried him the most was Huey Long, Louisiana politician. Long was a populist well before the Depression hit. I wouldn't necessarily say 1895 populist. I don't mean that kind. But I mean the ideas of protecting the common man against monopoly businesses, against the banks, against the utility companies, and especially in Louisiana, fearing that the oil companies had made all the profits at the expense of the little people. So he had always been someone who embraced those ideas. If you remember how populists had this feeling of kind of like damn the man, that's kind of the Huey Long theme from early politics on. So he's already in position advocating higher taxes on businesses, greater social programs, well before 1928 even. So when the Depression hits, he's a politician in place as governor already that's ahead of the New Deal. And in 1932, he does support FDR's candidacy. But 33, 34, and 35, Long starts to become the critic that FDR is not doing enough, that he's not delivering on the New Deal as he promised. And some of this is sincere in the respect that he thinks FDR is too slow paced, but a lot of it is that with the Depression and with the publicity that came with first governor, then later Senator Huey Long, he believed he could become the candidate himself in 36. He was really agitating to be the person that could say, FDR is not doing enough, the party needs to nominate me. And FDR felt it. There was friction between them. And although Long never got to the point where he ended up being anti-Zionist and anti-Jewish like Coughlin and others, he did still associate him with being a tool of the banking industry. Long advocated that every single person should receive $5,000 a year annual living wage just for being an American. That ought to be something the government guarantees someone. He wrote a book called Every Man a King, and his slogan was, Every Man a King, but no one wears a crown. And he organized what came to be known as Share the Wealth Clubs. And this is the Share the Wealth Clubs are really just these organizations that are campaigning to advocate redistribution of wealth and the election of Huey Long. That's the other purpose. Called the Kingfish, he was loved by the poor, but there's no getting around it. He had a dictatorial style of government that was somewhat similar to Hitler's. I don't mean he had people murdered, but I mean in terms of his, it was either Huey Long's way or no way. It's not even the highway. And he consolidated one of the strongest political machines that in any state government's history, keeping his family members after his death in office. He probably would have been a very, very serious contender as a presidential candidate in 36, taking away the nomination from sitting Roosevelt had he not been gunned down, which he was. Very convenient. Assassinated by a Carl Weiss, whom you won't have to know. I think it's spelled W-E-I-S-S. Angry because his father, a judge, had been so embarrassed and dragged into corruption through the long machine. A lot of good books, a lot of good films on it. All the King's Men by Robert Penn Warren is probably the best of it. It's fiction, but it's fiction based on good history. And there's a Jimmy Cagney film also, pretty much close to this. I can't remember the name of that film, but that addresses Long's life. So let's put these two ideas together we've been looking at. If Townsend talks about old age pensions and Long talks about annual living wages, again, what are both of these programs alluding to? Social Security. Social Security and unemployment insurance. Guaranteed welfare, unemployment insurance, and Social Security are all permanent features that come from that FDR seeks to implement in order to steal the thunder, to make sure that these critics on the left don't drag him away from office. Now, here's someone who's of lesser known background. I remember studying him in college. Kind of fell out of my lectures for a while until Wikipedia came back. Looked him up on Wikipedia last year, found some interesting things, and then went somewhere else to confirm that it was real. We're concerned about that. Here is a biography of Gerald K. Smith that you might find of some interest. I won't read it all, but I'll read interesting points. An ordained minister of the Disciple of Christ denomination of Christianity starting in 1916. In 1928, he moved to Louisiana because his wife contracted tuberculosis, and he discovered the Shreveport had a good reputation for working with tuberculosis patients. While serving as a minister in Shreveport, he made many radio broadcasts attacking local utility companies. And this is something that FDR would also go after, is the monopoly holding companies in the utility business. I didn't list the law for it. It's the Wheeler-Rayburn Act, but that's something that was a target for New Deal reform. But he attacked local utility companies and corruption while supporting trade unions. He became a friend of Huey Long in 1932. They together launched the Share Our Wealth Society. This movement proposed minimum and maximum limits on household wealth and income. Smith resigned his ministry and worked to recruit members to the society. One thing I forgot to mention was that the Share the Wealth Club had a plan of creating maximum wages. It's kind of an interesting thought. There's minimum wages and maximum. Unlike Long, no, I missed a paragraph. After Long was assassinated in 1935, Smith took over the society for a short time. Smith entered into an alliance with Francis Townsend, who we discussed, Father Coughlin, and Huey Long followers to form the Union Party. That party nominated William Lemke as their presidential candidate in the 1936 election. This is something I was going to add anyway to item 30 on the last page. William Lemke, L-A-M-K-E, third party candidate for the Union Party. He is the collective thunder on the left candidate.
Under what number?
30 on the last page. So, not to get bogged down in that election will have two very prominent third-party candidates, Norman Thomas, the socialist, and William Lemke, the Union Party candidate. Both of those are running from the left, so they're taking votes from FDR, from a liberal position. Back to our biography of Gerald K. Smith. Unlike Long, who was generally favorable to racial tolerance, Smith soon took the Share Our Wealth movement in the direction of white supremacy. Smith became associated with the Non-Interventionist America First Committee, which is on the sheets I gave you for the World War II thing. It was a group of isolationists that tried up to the day of Pearl Harbor, a little bit afterward even, to keep us out of World War II. Pat Buchanan's father was a strong organizer for the America First Committee, so that maybe tells us a little bit about Pat Buchanan's Fortress America thinking. After this group dissolved in the aftermath of Pearl Harbor, Gerald K. Smith formed the America First Party for Politics, where he ran for the U.S. Senate out of Michigan, and then later as a Republican, losing both elections. He ran in the 1944 presidential election as a third-party candidate, winning 1,700 votes. In 1948, he ran on the Christian Nationalist ticket, where he received, for president, 48 votes. Kind of a low turnout. And was ran as a write-in candidate in California in the 1956 presidential election, where he received 8 votes. I ran as a write-in candidate for House of Representatives a couple elections back and received 3 votes, my wife, son, and I. can't compare to Smith, I guess. Smith went on to suggest that the Holocaust never happened and that various politicians had a link to the big Jewish conspiracy. Shunned by most politicians, including even Strom Thurmond. Interesting Wikipedia drop in there. Who had distanced the states' rights Democratic Party away from Smith. Smith eventually moved... Here's the part I wanted to read. It's the best part. Smith eventually moved to Eureka Springs, Arkansas. In 1964, he began construction of a planned religious theme park. The park was never fully developed as originally planned. However, in 1966, the centerpiece of the plan, the Christ of the Ozark statue, was completed, overlooking the town of Magnetic Mountain at an elevation of 1,500 feet. The sculptor Emmett Sullivan had worked with Gutzon Borglum on one of the sculptures of Mount Rushmore. And by the way, Borglum, after he completed Stone Mountain, was run out of Georgia for being too much of a dangerous Klansman. There's a connection going here. Smith also had plans for a life-size recreation of an ancient Jerusalem in the hills near Eureka Springs. While this was never fully realized, each year an outdoor passion play inspired by the Oberaggerel ceremony in Germany is staged on a set over one-tenth of a mile long, located not far from the statue. Smith died in 1976 due to pneumonia. He and his wife were buried adjacent to the Christ of the Ozark statue. So a little linkage there to local history. Maybe not one who wanted it. Pardon? Oh, yeah? Yeah, with the lesbian headquarters of Eureka Springs. That would have... would have affected him. Sure. So think about it. Isn't this a strange time in politics when a Democrat has to worry about not being liberal enough? I've just never known that in life and what that would be like. Have to worry about the left. I mean, to even claim you're liberal is too dangerous in this day and age, but to not be liberal enough, that's what FDR was facing in the 1930s. So in response to that, that's why he pursues programs that are ever more beneficial to the disadvantaged and ever more expensive for those who are comfortable in society. In an effort to try to create more jobs, the Works Progress Administration is created in 1935. That is a replacement of the previous PWA, Public Works Administration. Much more massive scope and scale. It involved infrastructure building, things like stadiums and courthouses and schoolhouses, etc. Many of the things around here, if you look, you can find WPA plaques on it. Northside Football Stadium built by WPA. But in addition to construction projects, it included two other divisions, the NYA and FAP. The National Youth Administration was an agency that distributed grants of money to individuals to stay in high school and college. So what did the NYA eventually evolve into? Yep, scholarships and college loans and those kind of programs. It gets its start here, and of course, what's the thinking for that? Yeah, that people with higher education degrees generally, it is believed, help create a higher income base for the society. And in the meantime, they're not what? Causing trouble on the streets or looking for a job either. Less people competing for the limited number of jobs that were not around in the 30s by delaying. And this is some kind of a parallel to what happened after World War II. I don't know if I've mentioned this or not, but the Service and Readjustment Act, or GI Bill of Rights of 1944, which granted college money to veterans, it had a dual purpose. Generate a higher income base, but also slow down the mustering out of the service directly into the workforce. So the NYA would work in that scope.
So the Works Program Administration are in place of which program?
PWA, smaller infrastructure building program. And the Federal Arts Project, which paid artists, writers, musicians, muralists, etc., to do their work. Not that this was, you know, desperately needed in society, but it was something that gave people a chance to get paid to do what they do. There is actually quite a bit of good literature and art that came from this time period. Death of a Salesman was financed with New Deal money, the writing of that, even though it was published years later. Mm-hmm. So, and this idea of granting money to artists or creators of literature to do these things, what is this reminiscent of today? Well, National Endowment of the Arts, National Endowment of the Humanities. grants that go to writers and painters and students and researchers, et cetera, all get their start from the WPA period. So this is hotly contested by some. Some say that if the general public does not want that kind, if they won't in the capitalist market buy such music or buy such art, should we taxpayers be subsidizing art that can't even sell in the market? And, of course, what Giuliani likes to say a lot is, should we be being taxed for dirty art, for sacrilegious and filthy art, which, what, one out of every 10,000 grants turns out like that? But the image is that, you know, that we're all paying for dirty art through taxes. Well, that wasn't the intentions of the WPA. And, of course, Social Security, which we've already been hinting at, is a 1935 program, part of the Second New Deal, which embodied at that time old age pension and temporary relief for those, well, not temporary, relief for those that were either physically or mentally unable to hold a job or temporarily out of work. Frances Perkins, the first female cabinet secretary, Secretary of Labor, would administer Social Security. In fact, she told FDR she wouldn't take the job in 1933 unless he would seriously pursue something similar to what the Social Security came out to be. So she was a strong advocate that before the turn to the left when the Second New Deal occurred. 26 on the next page. The Revenue Act of 1935, or as it was nicknamed probably by both sides, the Soak the Rich Tax. This was truly the first serious graduated income tax. Even though graduated income tax were made legal in 1913, the degree of graduation was quite small in the progressive era and even reduced in the 20s. It didn't even begin to tax incomes under $50,000, which is quite a bit in 1935, but it did reach a 75% tax on incomes over $5 million. So you can see why this would be something hotly criticized by the community that's not voting for FDR. Incomes over $5 million, which I guess is pretty whopping, because that's like paying three and a half of the $5 million, maybe. If I was left with only $1.5 million a year, I'd be hurting. Yeah, I'd be screaming. But I know that's not the way to look at it. Just look at it. They're taking it by property wise. It's somehow.
Did you say under $50,000?
Under $50,000, no one was taxed. Especially in 1935, I'd be hurting the $1.5 million there. 27 is kind of out of place. It needs to go somewhere. I guess I can. The reason I put it in here is because those who helped them put together these Second New Deal programs were traditionally called the Brain Trust. The names Rexford Tugwell, Raymond Moley, and Farley, Jim Farley, are the ones that made this up. They in many ways were modeled after the Wisconsin idea of La Follette, who went to the University of Wisconsin and drew experts in transportation and criminology, public administration, and brought them into his state government. Well, this is FDR doing the same thing, drawing people from Harvard and Cornell and Princeton and places like that, or old buddies from Harvard, like these three were, to craft and mold these policies, which is pretty standard activity now. I mean, like, for example, in foreign policy, especially, who was the Harvard graduate that became Nixon's first national security advisor and then Secretary of State? Henry Kissinger. That's it. His academics that got him hired, and same for now for Bush's Secretary of State. Who's that? What's her credentials for foreign policy? Does she have any? A graduate of Stanford with honors and a Soviet expert, as well as law degree, but expert in Soviet affairs. So this is in keeping with the idea that trained collegiate academic experts should be involved in policy making. That's that brain trust concept that FDR first used at the presidential level before others did. Item 28, the Wagner Act, or National Labor Relations Act of 1935. This is an interesting watershed turning point in history. Patterned off of Section 7A of the NIRA, and you recall that the NIRA was done in 1936 by the Schechter-Poultry case. Built upon that aspect, though, Section 7A guaranteed that unions have the right to organize. And was there a question legally about the right for unions to organize before? Some states had actually questioned whether or not they were, in essence, terrorist organizations just by definition. You can't, you know, it's totally off topic here. If you're a member of Hamas, is that legal in America? It's not anymore, is it? It ought to be, I think. Not that I'm pro Hamas, I didn't mean that, but who is Hamas? It's the Palestinian organization that has never accepted Israel's right to exist and has perpetual war declared on Israel. Now, it's understandable why in Israel it's declared a terrorist organization. Why is it in America if they have not declared war in the U.S. government? There's the linkage, the hinted linkage that we are a recognition government of Israel, and therefore we have ties and obligations as the obligation. So just the organization's existence is illegal in America. You're not allowed to be in it. In fact, there was a student up in Fayetteville that got into immigration problems for declaring he was a member of Hamas. And I think did he get it deported? Yeah, I thought he did, just for being American, more than just that, but that was the major case. It's not the same thing, but prior to the 1930s, a number of states looked at labor union membership the same way. Just being a member of the IWW or being a member of Knights of Labor, etc., was considered dangerous enough to be a terrorist organization. The AFL fought very hard to shed that image. That's why they were loyal in World War I. That's why they didn't recruit unskilled workers. But because of when strikes and violence occurred, labor unions often got branded that way. That's why, different from the 20s for sure, they took a beating for being seen that way. So when 1935, the Wagner Act passed, says that labor unions have the right to exist. Not only do they have the right to exist from a federal level, this would override all state laws, that it's a legal organization by First Amendment association. It also establishes what's called the National Labor Relations Board, which was a government agency whose purpose was to oversee when businesses abuse workers' rights as union members. So in our previous discussions, when labor unrest reached across state boundary problems, federal troops were drawn in. They were drawn in the 1894 Pullman strike and the Homestead Steel strike. Militia were brought in, the Great Railroad strike. Always in the past, it was federal troops being brought in to subdue labor unrest. And now here in 1935, they're saying you have the right to organize and we will have an agency whose purpose is to protect you from business abuse. John L. Lewis, head of the CIO, who we will talk about shortly, gave a gigantic contribution to FDR's re-election bid in 1936 on the promise that the handing of the check and the shaking of hands was all photographed and could be put in front page newspapers. And so what's going on there? It's the tying of unions now are union and government, but especially unions and FDR and the Democratic Party. This is where the Democratic Party becomes so closely associated with unionism and the labor movement. And not as loyal as the black community, but nonetheless, usually the union movement has stayed voting Democratic ever since 1935 because of the Wagner Act. Number 29. I think I alluded to this earlier, but let's say it again. The Supreme Court, well, let's think about this a second. One of the way the government was set up, let's just kind of review our civics for a second. How often do House members run? Have to run. 2 years, every 2 years, all of them. Senators, every 6 years, so one-third every 2 years. Is that presidents? And the whole purpose of this is to ask this question. Court judges? Never again. Yeah, they don't, if they ran for the first time. Yeah. So what is the rationale? I mean, say we have a mood change and we want to throw all the bums out. The judges, the presidents, everybody. When do we get that opportunity to do it all in one election? We don't. purposely don't. We have to string it out over at least 6 years, and we don't ever get it to court. And you know, it's at this point of the class that every once in a while, rarely at the college level, but always at the high school level, I get, well, what about assassination? Wouldn't that work on the judges? They're always wanting to use that check and balance in the high school level. They watch the Pelican Brief movie. You know, they say that almost kind of like, couldn't that be an option? Funny. But so what I'm getting at is that it's very feasible that you'll have judges sitting on the court who are not of the same generation or the same political philosophy of the congressional seat holders and the president. That's kind of true today. I mean, the oldest judge left on the court, John Paul Stevens, appointed by Gerald Ford in the 70s. Republican nominee, but he's one of the most liberal judges left on the court. He's not someone who's in harmony with Reaganomics and Bush policies. So that would mean that what could happen in regards to the judicial review on laws? Yes, and that's exactly what happens in the 1930s, is we're looking at judges on the Supreme Court that were appointed in the teens and at the earliest in the 20s. Even if they were Democratic appointees under Wilson, that was in a far more conservative political age. So all the judges sitting on the court had come from a time period when the court ruled protecting property over government policies, striking down minimum wage laws, striking down safety standards laws, anti-child labor laws. This was a court quite conservative and pro-property and pro-business rather than anywhere favorable to the New Deal. So there is, you can find a long list of cases. The two most famous are the Butler case of 1935 and the Schechter poultry case, also known as the sick chicken case of 1936. Butler overturned the Agricultural Adjustment Act. Schechter overturned the National Industrial Recovery Act. Yeah, it's here in 29. The Butler case overturned the Agricultural Adjustment Act, and the Schechter poultry case overturned the National Recovery Act, also known as the National Industrial Recovery Act. So if you were the president who felt like the majority of the voters want you and are going to reelect you to promote New Deal programs, the majority of the Congress passed those programs, how would you feel about such a court?
Assassinated.
I wonder if FDR got that thought. Well, his thinking was, when we win re-election in 1936 with an even larger mandate, then we'll take on the court. And that's what he will do. First, the 1936 election in number 30. FDR's renominated. Alf Landon, the governor of Kansas, becomes the Republican opponent. Anybody ever heard of Nancy Kassebaum? She was a senator from Kansas for a number of years, 80s into the 90s. She was daughter of Alf Landon, governor of Kansas. We talked about those other two third-party candidates, Norman Thomas for the Socialist, William Lemke for the Union Party. When the vote was cast, FDR received 523 electoral votes, the highest electoral count ever before that time. Not the highest in record, though. I believe both Reagan and Nixon got higher electoral votes and popular vote. But there were more electors and more people, so maybe that factors. Asterisks next to the wins. Alf Landon received 8 votes, like Taft did in 1908. 1912. And the only two states to vote Republican were Maine and Vermont. And prior to this election, it was quite traditional to have Maine be the state that it seemed to luckily always guess the presidency. They had guessed it wrong in 32, but before 1932, the expression was, as goes Maine, so goes the nation, saying they just had the mystic ability to guess the winner. But sarcastically, Democrats rephrased that to say, in this election, as goes Maine, so goes Vermont. And the only two states to vote for. The explanation for this whopping victory, it's hard to say that he had whooped the Depression because he really hadn't. He had coped. He had created jobs, but as far as the degree of unemployment was quite high. and the economic woes were still very much there. Without government support, without artificial programs, it would have been as bad as during the Hoover years. But a lot of it has to do with the confidence that FDR seemed to communicate. That someone, and there's a line, if you ever watched the movie Seabiscuit, where they have David McCullough, who does the PBS over voices, he's doing little black and white scenes in there. There was a scene where they're showing all the work programs and the exuberance of people, and he says, I think they called it the New Deal, and people knew for the first time in a long time, somebody finally gave a damn. That kind of voice in the movie, I think, is what voters went to the polls with. Not so much actually seeing concrete difference in the economy, but feeling that somebody in the White House this time cared for their... There was hope. That's what I was looking at. But also, FDR won this thing because he had put together a powerful election coalition called the New Deal Coalition, which included Southern whites, which was not unusual. That was true already. Southern white voters, which stayed in the party all the way until the 1960s. Northern working class people, which shifted back and forth in the party, but they're solidly in the party. The ethnic voters, the Irish, the Eastern European, Italian voters, all solidly in the party. Western farmers, this is something that farmers usually owed their allegiance to the Republican Party, but appreciation for the Agricultural Adjustment Act, when they did not get McNary-Hagan, and real assistance brought farmers into the party, and labor, which had been apolitical prior to this. Prior to this election, labor unions did not rank and file go out and vote for given candidates of any party suggested to them. But they now became loyal supporters. So labor unions, Southerners, Western farmers, working class people, and then the newest addition to the New Deal coalition, the black vote. Black voters prior to this time had voted which way? When they could vote in the North. Republican, out of appreciation for Lincoln. And as you've heard this story before, but I like to tell it a couple of times, that community leaders said, go home and turn that picture of Lincoln to the wall because that debt is paid in full. So from 1936 on, African American voters started voting and have stayed to the tune of 90% loyal to the party. So the New Deal coalition not only re-elects FDR in 1936, but in 40 and in 44, keeps Truman elected in 48, and with the exception of the Eisenhower elections of 52 and 56, brings Johnson or Kennedy and Johnson back to place. What unravels it? Why, after the 1960s, is that solid block of Democratic majorities eaten away at? Vietnam. There's the popularity of Nixon. A lot of it also is the belief, and it's probably true, that the party, which had primarily stood for working class values, had become the party of, how was it said? Grass, expensive gas, and ass. That was one of the slogans. In other words, promiscuous social behavior, drugs, and causing high gas prices. That tended to be what people saw, that the party became way too liberal. Pandering and catering to every minority and forgetting the white working class male that it had started with. Which takes in that including women voters also. So the Democratic Party, and I think the civil rights issue is the one that does it the most for the South. But while the New Deal was going, it was a solid and winning coalition. And with that, FDR comes out of the election. If you can remember Bush calling mandate when he came out, what was the mandate Bush thought he had after the re-election? He even made the phrase that my victory gave me some political capital and I plan to spend it. It's the reference, the idea that I have more power than was previously expected because they want me back, they re-elected me. What was Bush's targets? Obviously the war is one of them, continuing the war. Well, he's thinking that enough people voted for him that he could I don't say railroad, but encourage Congress to do something. What was it he wanted to reform? Social Security. That's the one that he said was the mandate that people wanted, and if it was, it wasn't the mandate Congress saw, because it didn't come about. FDR, what was his mandate? More New Deal programs, and more New Deal programs that are not going to be hurt by the court. So the way he's going to do this is, he's going to adjust the numbers on the court. FDR puts forward, early in 1937, a proposal that for every judge over age 70, another judge be appointed. So move the number, and there was six of them over 70. So move the number of judges from 9 to 15. Now the Supreme Court has fluctuated in numbers before. It's been as low as 6, been as high as 12. All of those changes were in the 19th century, and after the 20th century had gotten started, it had pretty well fixed, not by law, but by tradition at 9. So to add these many judges, potentially legal if Congress did it, was not in the spirit of check and balance, but in the spirit of the presidential and congressional branches ganging up on the courts. And this fell right into the pattern of criticism that people were saying that FDR was turning into a damn dictator. He wanted everything his way. Anybody that gets in his way is to be axed. So you hear a lot of liberals complain about Bush today, but Bush never tried to add 60 judges to the court. Of course, he got a friendly court, too. But that's where FDR went with this. And this plan was fought out on the floor of Congress from February, when it was introduced, all the way until the summer. Well, the court, in late spring, early summer, passes a case or adjudicates on a case which changes the position they had traditionally held, and that was they had opposed minimum wage hours laws, arguing that violated the rights of property and the rights for business liberty. But in the West Coast Hotel versus Parrish case, they upheld Washington State's minimum wage law. And with that, it sent the signal that the court is going to become more friendly and protective of New Deal measures. Once the court made that change, members of Congress in his own party, Democrats, began to break with FDR. They're not excited about the court packing plan to begin with, but now they don't see a need for it. If the court's going to start mellowing out and not overturning New Deal laws, there's no reason for the packing. That's why it gets the expression, a switch in time saves nine, meaning a switch in the way they decided on the cases. And shortly thereafter, William Van Deventer says he will resign for the opportunity for FDR to appoint a replacement judge. And when it's all said and done, four different judges will eventually resign and be replaced by pro-New Deal judges. So the court packing plan now has really no purpose anymore. But it was still being fought out up into the summer by Senate Majority Leader Joe Robinson, the Arkansas running mate of Al Smith. But he dies. And so Robinson dies. The court switches on its opinions, Van Deventer steps down, and that's the end of the court packing plan. So you might say he lost the battle, but he won the war, is what they say about the court packing plan. You know, I think if we stop now, we can have enough for one more class and review. So we can do, because there's really not a lot left to do, we can do 32 through 39 when we return. I'll try my best to circle the right numbers you need to know. We can review anything that you want to go over next time around. It's actually over 70 years and 6 months, but I just said 70 years. So if there's anything you want to ask me from World War I to the 20s to the 30s when we come back, we'll have plenty of time for that. Before you walk, if you like, we could have a big giant review quiz. No? Okay. Let the tyranny of the majority rule.